From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. It is Earth Day, and President Biden is making big promises. He kicked off an international climate summit by pledging to cut the country's greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030, and he urged world leaders to work together in his opening remarks to the virtual conference.
This is a moral imperative, an economic imperative, a moment of peril, but also a moment of extraordinary possibilities. Time is short, but I believe we can do this, and I believe that we will do this.
NPR national correspondent Jeff Brady is following this story. And Jeff, this is a pretty ambitious goal. What would the U.S. need to do to cut emissions by half?
Well, we're certainly going to get more details in coming months before a big climate meeting in Glasgow in November. But we know the administration wants to set a national clean energy standard. That would require increasing amounts of electricity generated from fuels that don't emit the greenhouse gases fossil fuels do now. And in the president's more than $2 trillion infrastructure proposal, there's a fundamental remaking of the country's entire power grid, phasing out coal power plants, more renewable energy, and more transmission lines to get wind and solar power to where it's needed. The administration frames this as an economic opportunity. All that work will require hiring lots and lots of people to do it. And the administration wants big changes in transportation. Biden wants a fast ramp up of electric vehicles. So he's proposing incentives to buy EVs and more charging stations around the country.
That infrastructure plan you mentioned would need to pass through Congress. How much help does he need from lawmakers to make cuts this deep?
Congress is going to have to take action, and we're already seeing bills circulating that likely will become part of a bigger package in coming weeks. One of the big challenges this administration faces is that Democrats have a narrow margin in the Senate. They have a better chance of getting some things passed through budget reconciliation, but some items might not be able to be included in a reconciliation package. The administration says it wants help from Republican lawmakers, but it's not clear they're going to get it.
No matter what happens on Capitol Hill, the president is clearly sending a message here that the U.S. wants to lead on climate change after the Trump administration dropped out of the Paris Climate Accord. Do you get the sense, Jeff, that the international community is hearing that message?
Yes. Other countries, they're responding by increasing their own commitments today to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Japan increased its emission reductions from 26% to 46%. That's based on 2013 levels. South Korea vowed to no longer finance coal power plant construction in other countries. One environmental group called that a historic step. And Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, increased his country's commitment, aiming for carbon neutrality by 2050. That's a decade earlier than a previous commitment. And Bolsonaro reaffirmed his country's pledge to end illegal deforestation in the Amazon by 2030. But he also has said that Brazil should be paid for keeping the Amazon intact, and figuring that out may be a sticking point down the road.
And then there's China. Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke after Biden today. China, of course, now the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter. Here's President Xi through an interpreter.
China will strive to peak carbon dioxide emissions before 2030 and achieve carbon neutrality before 2060. China has committed to move from carbon peak to carbon neutrality in a much shorter time span than what might take many developed countries.
So promising peak emissions by 2030, that is a contrast from Biden's promise to cut them in half by then. Can you put what China is trying to do into context?
Yeah, it's still significant. There were questions about whether China was even going to show up to this summit. So just being there is important. And under the Paris Agreement, there's a recognition that developing economies don't have the long history of emitting greenhouse gases that countries like the U.S. do. So emerging economies were given more time to get their emissions under control. China is coming back now and saying it will limit the increase of coal consumption in the next 5 years and phase it down in the 5 years after that. It's an important commitment, but of course, one that many will be watching to hold China accountable.
I understand that scientists are warning that the world is already way behind where it needs to be with emissions. So do you think that what Biden is promising and what China and others are promising, will that even be enough to prevent a climate disaster?
Well, we know that the Paris Climate Agreement wasn't enough, and the U.S. wasn't even on track to meet those commitments. Now countries are boosting their pledges, And even more is needed on top of that. We're already seeing the effects of climate change with more extreme heat waves, storms, and wildfires. Still, you know what's happening now? This is progress. There are no enforcement mechanisms. The whole country is accountable for these promises. They all have to trust each other to live up to their commitments that they're making, and then, of course, increase them again in the future.
NPR's Jeff Brady, thank you very much.
Thank you.
More than half of all Americans have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. And in some states, the numbers are much lower. In Alabama, for instance, 30% of people are fully or partially vaccinated. And there are several reasons why. Some people are hesitant or indifferent, or they simply don't have access. And racial disparities persist. So how are doctors there reaching out to patients of color? Let's bring in Dr. Dina Maxwell Stafford, who is a family physician at Tuskegee, Alabama, which is 96% Black. It's also the site where the infamous Tuskegee syphilis study was carried out, which has loomed over this pandemic in the minds of many Americans. Dr. Stafford, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. You know, let's start with this idea of folks being hesitant. How have they been expressing that hesitancy to you, and how are you responding to it?
So I think when we talk about hesitancy, we need to really focus that we have hesitancy and we have vaccine refusal. We have a lot more people that are just in that stage of, I need to understand more, I have some concerns. In Tuskegee, we have a lot of people who are directly impacted by the public health study on syphilis. And so when people initially hear about this new treatment, new availability, they have some concerns. And so one of the things that I try to talk with them about is that this is a little different in the sense that we know that this has positive outcomes and that the government is actively trying to get this to vulnerable populations. This is almost the exact opposite of what was done when they allowed disease to progress untreated. Now we're saying we have an intervention that's helpful and we want to get it to the most vulnerable population.
This is interesting because what you're saying here is that you're having conversations that are long overdue with community members about the Tuskegee experiment. It was several decades ago, and still it's at the forefront of many people's minds when they're thinking about this vaccine.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that people should appreciate is these are conversations that people of color have been having as they encounter the healthcare system for years. And so I think now we're just seeing this and multiple other conversations around mistreatment, mistrust, institutional racism that have impacted people in my community for years.
We're hearing reports about shots going unused in nearby states like Mississippi. Is that also happening there in Alabama?
So I think you have that everywhere because of the mechanism by which you have to give shots. And these shots have to match the number of vaccines in a given dose with the appointments for that day. And so you're hearing some reports of unused vaccines, but what I've seen in this area is people are eager to get the vaccine. Again, you do have people who are just saying, you know, hey, I'm not sure about that yet. But I've been personally pleased with the number of people that have gone from that let's wait and see phase to actually getting a vaccine.
On this problem of access, in particular, people in the Black Belt generally have less access to physical health care. What has this vaccine rollout and the pandemic itself, what has that said to you about this larger issue of the lack of access? It's kind of laid bare a systemic problem.
These are struggles that we've had, especially in primary care in rural areas for years. You know, when you talk about a pandemic, it did get difficult because in most of your Black Belt counties, you only have one or two outpatient providers. But we also had to balance people with chronic health conditions versus people with COVID symptoms. And so that got to be a juggling act. So now add to that vaccine rollout. You know, I do vaccine clinics in the morning 2 days a week, and I do regular clinic the other days. So it's required people to become creative and to be adaptive to meet the needs of the community.
Are you finding a silver lining in these searches for creative ways to serve the community that might be used once we're out of this pandemic?
Absolutely. So for me personally, I would have probably been a slow adapter of telemedicine. But with that being said, it's also brought to the forefront infrastructure. Some of our patients can't do telemedicine because their internet speed doesn't allow them to connect. But I think overall, one of the personal silver linings is this thrust of issues of mistrust, health disparities. And so I think this has caused a national conversation to help us address these issues. So, you know, everything hasn't been awful. It's been difficult, but I think we'll come out of it in a better space going forward.
That's Dr. Dina Maxwell Stafford, a family physician in Tuskegee, Alabama. Dr. Stafford, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Back in 2015, I did a series of television reports on policing, and after they aired, I was contacted by two lieutenants in the Bellevue, Washington Police Department, a suburb of Seattle where 35% of the population identifies as East and South Asian. They were trying to figure out ways to improve their relationships with communities of color, and they wanted insights that would help them in that effort. Well, 6 years later, as the nation digs into what police training, accountability, and reform could look like, I wanted to check back in with Bellevue PD to see if their efforts have made an impact. And Bellevue Police Chief Steve Milette joins us now for more. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So, Chief, over the last 5 years or so, there's been this national emphasis on implicit bias training. But we're also seeing this emerging research that shows that while understanding implicit bias gives us insights into the causes of, say, racially biased policing, there are as of yet no known straightforward effective intervention programs on this front. What has been your department's experience specifically with implicit bias training? Does it actually help?
It really does, Tanya. And I think one of the things that I have found, and I think my employees here have found most effective, is trying to put yourself in the shoes of the individual. Bellevue is an ethnic minority majority, and we have people in Bellevue that come from all around the world. And getting to know the culture, getting to know the customs, getting to know who they are, better equips our officers, our civilian staff, to interact with the very diverse community that we have the privilege of serving. I found that real-world interaction is as effective as sitting in a classroom and knowing the mechanics of implicit bias and where it will show up.
What are some of the challenges that you've encountered in this effort to get community input and for your police officers to understand where the community is coming from?
Fear of the police, not knowing who we are and what we represent. Again, we have a lot of first-generation immigrants in Bellevue, and what law enforcement represents to them where they've come from is much different than what we represent in Bellevue. So getting in front of them and breaking down those barriers of communication and showing them through our actions who we are has been fruitful here in Bellevue, but it has been definitely a challenge to overcome. When I interview for the job here in Bellevue, this is not something that most chiefs would, or most people would want to say to a city manager, the hiring authority, as you're competing for a job. But I told them, I said, if I'm successful leading the men and women of this police department, one of the things that's going to happen is crime is going to increase. Reported crime is going to increase. And he just kind of looked at me. I said, I am convinced that there are people in our community that are not reporting crimes either out of fear of the police or they don't want to bother the police or whatever the reason is. If we're successful and we're interacting with people effectively, we're going to break down those barriers of communication, establish the trust and earn the trust, and we will actually start seeing people coming forward to report crime. We don't want people suffering in silence.
Have you had an increase in people reporting crimes?
We have, actually. You know, after one of our town hall meetings, there was a Latina. She actually reached out to one of my officers that's on our Latino Advisory Council, and she reported that she had been sexually abused by her supervisor, for a period of time, and that what he was hanging over her head was he would call ICE if she reported it. And as we dug deeper, there were more victims that he had been targeting with the same tactic. And so we were able to, you know, intervene and bring some people to justice.
Well, in addition to your own efforts, there have also been calls for other changes to policing there. Earlier this month, the city of Bellevue got the results of an independent review of policing that came out with a list of recommended police reforms, which includes a ban on neck restraints and chokeholds, but also broader things like de-escalation policies and the consideration of using body cameras. What reforms are you going to be implementing?
So definitely, we were already working on establishing a camera program that has been actually in flight for like the last year and a half, 2 years. Some of the other reforms that we're looking at from the OIR report include how we use our website. And there's 47 that they made. But as you look through them, Tanya, is what's important in there as well, at least to me, is what's not in there. And what's not in there is that we have any sort of reputation or history of using excessive force and violating the constitutional rights of the public.
Well, let's talk a little bit about deadly force specifically. I mean, another recommendation asks the department to prohibit the use of deadly force against people who are in danger only to themselves. What are the policies right now at your department? When exactly are officers told to use deadly force?
In my view, and it is our policy, that the only time that deadly force is authorized is if the individual you're dealing with is posing a danger to the officer or someone else. And it's got
to
be.
How do you assess that? I'm sorry to interrupt you, Chief, but
no,
how do you assess that? Because it's up to the officer to say whether he or she feels, based on what they see, could be a threat. And as we see, people see things differently based on where they stand.
So it's in the training. Many times it is a split-second decision as you're assessing all these different points of information that are coming at you. Fortunately, and I'm knocking on wood here, we have not had a use of deadly force in close to 6 years in Bellevue. It is the most significant decision an officer will ever make in their career is to use deadly force. And when you see it, at least for in my 32 years as a police officer, you know it because it is that significant. It's when a person is truly posing a danger to somebody else or the officer. And it's got to be a reasonable danger, Tanya. It can't. You know, it's got to stand up to the test of our policies, our procedures, but also the community standards.
Are you disturbed when you see these videos come out showing what feels like for the public to be unlawful use of force?
So George Floyd's death, his murder, we were all significantly impacted by that. And if people weren't, then I would have to question why. That was an incredible video to watch. I can't watch it anymore.
Derek and yet Chauvin, there are other videos that we've seen since then that call into question the use of force. There is just a case out of Columbus, Ohio, involving a teenage girl. What do you want to see happen in the larger discourse around this? You've laid out beautifully the way that your department is taking on policing in your community. But what do you think needs to happen right now nationally?
So I think what needs to happen right now nationally is in that specific incident, I think the investigation needs to take place. I don't know enough about it. I've watched the video, and I'm always hesitant to weigh in on a case before everything has been looked at and examined and investigated. Again, George Floyd's situation was much different because we saw it right there, 9 minutes laying on his neck. Under no circumstances was that acceptable. But in the circumstance in Columbus, Ohio, I think we need to let the investigation take its course. And I am relatively sure that the investigation agency or the investigating body will come forward and lay out the case for the public.
Point taken. Understood. You know, Chief, before I let you go, I just want to ask you, what does it mean to you when you hear people say, we don't need more training? What we need is a change of the policing system.
Tanya, there's, and I say this frequently, there is no way in this world that anybody legitimately and reasonably can argue that there are not systemic racist pieces of our systems that are still in place, because it was founded on a system that excluded people, minimized people, and didn't even acknowledge, you know, people as human beings. And I am so happy that we're finally having this conversation. But the thing I get concerned about is that discussions and engagement are very important. But when we're yelling and screaming at each other, then the communication starts breaking down. And I don't think that we're going to go back to sleep as a nation, because, you know, you've been around for a while. You know that every time a flashpoint happens, everybody, yes, we need change. We need to do this. We need to do that. And then we go back to sleep until the next event happens. And I don't think we're going back to sleep. And I really, really hope that we don't.
Steve Milette is chief of police in Bellevue, Washington. Chief, thank you so much for your time in this conversation.
Thank you, Tanya.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
A new survey explores why some Republican voters are skeptical about getting COVID-19 vaccines. At least half of the adults in the U.S. have had at least one shot. Meanwhile, 40% of Republican voters say they do not plan on getting vaccinated. Republican pollster Frank Luntz asked some of those voters, when you hear about the vaccine, what word or phrase comes to mind?
Government shutdowns.
Today, no. The word no.
I think it's going to be too invasive.
Right. For people who want it, but I don't know the long-term effects, and I want to wait and see.
Pollster Frank Luntz joins us now to talk about his findings. Frank, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you. So first, tell us a little bit more about this focus group of GOP voters you surveyed this week with the De Beaumont Foundation. Who are they, and where do they come from?
Well, the De Beaumont Foundation is dedicated to a nonpartisan, nonpolitical approach to issues of health and safety across the country. And we know from polling over the last 2 or 3 months that Republicans have been less likely to consider the vaccine and more concerned about side effects and just the politicization of COVID. And so this was a decision to try to understand what those concerns are and address them. And I'm going to give you the three strongest message points to them. First is that very likely their own doctor has been vaccinated already. Over 90% of doctors have taken the vaccine. Second is that vaccine, for so many people who take a flu shot, the vaccine is actually safer and it's more effective than even a flu shot. And third, that COVID itself, the virus, is so random and so destructive and so dangerous that it's essential that you do whatever you can to keep yourself safe, keep your friends, your family safe. And it's the surest way that we can get back to a normal life is to get people vaccinated.
Well, you asked participants whether returning to normal was a good argument for getting vaccinated. But some in this group found that promise of normalcy misleading. Let's listen.
I started with give us 2 weeks. And here we are over a year later. So when does it stop?
The lure of freedom is tremendous, but it's kind of like a Ponzi scheme. You don't know what you're getting a short-term return, but you don't know if it's going to last.
What else did you hear from those Republican voters about the vaccines that really stood out to you?
Three things: that it's important that we keep politics out of this. Second is that they give Donald Trump credit for the speed of the vaccine that was developed, and they give Joe Biden credit for how quickly it's been distributed, and they expect both to work together on this. And third that it's their decision, and they want to make the decision themselves.
Hmm. What was most striking to you in the 30 seconds that I have? What are some of the takeaways or the main takeaway for you?
Two things now, and I sound like a mathematician. At first, is what Joe Biden. I know what Joe Biden says in the State of the Union address is going to be very important, and he really has to avoid politics in his messaging. Mm. And second is that this is not just for themselves. You're taking it for your kids. You're taking it for your parents. Yeah. And
Pollster
you're
Frank Lutz,
America
I've got to let you go. But yep. Thank you so much for your reporting. Thank you so much.
If you live in a southwestern city, how hot your neighborhood gets likely depends on how much money you have. A recent study shows that poor Latino neighborhoods in places like Albuquerque, Phoenix, and Fresno are up to 7 degrees hotter than wealthier, whiter neighborhoods. It's a dangerous formula as the climate gets even hotter. Jake D'Alessandro is a doctoral student at UC Davis and lead author of that study. Jake, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And what did you take away from this study about heat in cities? What's your top line?
The main takeaway was that if you unfortunately are low income and you have the lowest amount of resources to combat or mitigate the ill effects from urban heat, you actually are unequally exposed to it and share more of a burden than, say, wealthier neighborhoods or whiter neighborhoods, for lack of a better word.
Well, some of the biggest disparities you found were in Southern California, where it might be up to 7 degrees hotter in low-income neighborhoods. Just give me a sketch of one of those neighborhoods and why that might be.
Let's take the Coachella Valley, which was one of the many cities that had this 7-degree difference, and that's Palm Springs, La Quinta, Cathedral City. If you look at a low-income area, it's very barren desert. There's very little shaded structure. It's all single-story, a lot of like blacktop parking lots, and then, of course, barren desert. And then if you were to look at their more wealthier counterparts across town, it's like an oasis. It almost looks like you could be in Miami instead of the middle of the desert. There's a lot of lush green vegetation, a lot of tree canopy, and then the building configuration produces a lot of shade and also has a lot of smart infrastructure. LEED buildings, which have less of a heating impact and cost less to cool. So it's not that the heat is seeking out low-income neighborhoods. It's just that the urban fabrics or the complexion of the surface, like concrete, impervious surface, is more prevalent and like lack of vegetation in these cities.
And some people might not think that 4 to 7 degrees is that big of a difference, but I mean, it really can be, right? I mean, what are the impacts of hotter temperatures in poorer neighborhoods?
In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really seem like it's a whole lot of a big difference. But if you're living in one of these cities, and you had mentioned that you have lived in Phoenix, that it's going to be 105 degrees today, but you live in one of these neighborhoods and it's 110, 111. And for a lot of us, you know, it's an inconvenience for urban heat or heat in general. We turn our air conditioning on and we pay, let's say, $25 more in electric bills. But for these neighborhoods that don't have the social capital and also, like, you know, the financial resources, that $25 can be something that's very, very hard to come by. Heat is the most deadly of all our weather-related mortality, and it gets underreported. And I believe it gets underreported because to a lot of us, it's just an inconvenience. We just spend more on these utilities. But if you have to decide between, oh, I have to pay my rent or I have to feed my children or I can run the AC, AC is going to be the lowest priority, which puts you susceptible to this heat-related sickness and, God forbid, heat-related mortality.
I'm listening to what you're saying, and I think it is so much more than about the heat or the weather. This is a question of economic justice, of racial justice. What does it say to you about the way that we have built and segregated American cities throughout our history?
You know, it says a lot, and I'm really glad that you bring this up. There's been some really great studies out there that by colleagues of mine across different universities where these neighborhoods that have been redlined, so essentially segregated based on the real estate market, that neighborhoods that are redlined have a huge susceptibility, vulnerability, and exposure to this extreme heat. It's an environmental justice and a climate justice issue. It's very similar to how if you look at cities that have Superfund sites, the sites that are nearest to this pollution or, you know, huge toxic waste exposure are often the same neighborhoods that are experiencing this extreme heat. We're hoping with our research that, you know, we find the data from more of the quantitative side And then maybe there could be a policy that will be put in place eventually based on these studies to help allocate resources. Because in a city like Phoenix or Bakersfield, California, you can't go and cool the entire city. It's just not realistic. You have a limited amount.
So what are you going to do? Plant some trees? Is that enough?
That would be ideal. You would definitely reduce the heat. You would reduce the carbon footprint because you'd have carbon sequestering. But in these dryland cities that we were focusing on, it comes at the cost of water resources. So you need to allocate the limited amount of resources that you have, which would include, like you mentioned, planting more trees, planting more vegetation, but also doing things like increasing albedo. And albedo is just a measure of reflectivity. So if you have a lot of roof, you know, black tar roofs, if you could change that to a lighter shade or even just make it a white roof, that would have more reflectivity, which means that your home or your building and business would not absorb as much heat and you would have a less of a utility bill and you would, you know, suffer less. Now that only cools the building. It doesn't have the adjacent cooling effect that vegetation has, but it's at least a start.
Is it safe to say that this is only going to get worse? These neighborhoods are only going to get hotter if we don't do anything about it.
Yes. All these climate projections for mid-century and late century shows that cities are going to warm an additional 3, 4, 5 degrees. Yeah, I'm expecting the problem to get worse, the temperatures to increase. But if we are able to do something, we can mitigate it and hopefully mitigate it completely.
All right. Jake D'Alessandro is a doctoral student at UC Davis. He's lead author on a study that found poorer and Latino neighborhoods are often hotter than the wealthier, whiter neighborhoods across cities in the southwestern United States. And Jake, we're going to go to Tucson next and see what it's like to live in one of those hot neighborhoods. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to talk to Becky Quintero. She lives in the appropriately named Sunnyside neighborhood of Tucson. Becky, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And does that sound right to you, Becky? Does it feel hotter there in your neighborhood than in other parts of town?
Yes, it does. It is a hotter part of town. You know, we are in the valley. You know, the mountains that surround us, you know, they get the rain, they get the greenery. We get bypassed with the rain. So it is very hot.
What's it like to live there on the hottest days of the year?
Oh, well, it can get to be 115 on some really hot days. You don't go outside when it's the peak of the heat. You just find the shade or stay inside, drink some water, lots of water. I feel sorry for people who are having to catch the bus to go places because they have to be outside and there's very little shade around the bus stops. And so you'll see people with t-shirts over their head to protect themselves from the sun. And you see little kids with red faces standing at the bus stop with their parents. It's really sad. You wish there was more shade structures for the bus stops.
Well, it's sad, but it's also dangerous, right? I mean, does everyone in your neighborhood, as far as you know, have air conditioning?
Oh, no. No, we still have the swamp coolers and fans. Unless you're really wealthy to afford the air conditioning, it's not very prevalent in the neighborhood.
I understand you're a leader there in the Sunnyside Neighborhood Association. Is this heat something that you've been talking about in your community for a while? What's it like to get people's attention on this?
Actually, you know, there was an article in the paper not too long ago. And so I had friends call me and say, hey, what can we do to help? How about we donate trees and then you plant them in the area where you know you need them in the south side? So that was very helpful. And we've been planting trees for over 10 years in specific parts of the neighborhood. We did a project in 2009 with the fire station down the street, and we planted 20 trees along one of the streets that had nothing for the kids to walk home from school with. So those trees are now, you know, 10 years later, they're now starting to produce the shade that we really need for walking down our bike boulevard. Yeah. So
does it frustrate you to see the differences between the richer and poorer communities, between the white and Latino communities?
You know, I've lived in my neighborhood since I was born. It's not frustrating to me. It's just because I've always lived here. And so it's just the way Tucson is. We're hot and we live near the airport. We hardly get rain. It's just we try to do the best we can with what we have. And we don't complain, because my dad taught us that if we complain, you better come up with a solution. So It's hot, we plant trees. You know, you just do what you can to better your community.
Becky Quintero lives in the Sunnyside neighborhood on the south side of Tucson, Arizona. Becky, stay cool and stay safe this summer, okay? Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
For the first time during this pandemic, Canada has recorded more new cases of COVID-19 per capita than the United States. For more on what's going on, let's check in with Colin Furness. He's an epidemiologist at the University of Toronto in Ontario, where strict lockdowns are now in place as cases surge. And Dr. Furness, welcome. Let's start with your own province, Ontario. What is fueling this spread?
It is mostly being driven by the UK variant, sometimes called B117, that's about twice as contagious as classic COVID. It's striking younger people, and we have seen it rip through the province with devastating results. Our ICUs are virtually full. We're getting really close to having to triage. It happened around the time we started to open things up. We predicted pretty much to the week with our modeling that this was going to happen, but the government looked at it and said, we're not sure. Let's wait and see. And so that's the situation we're in.
You mentioned the UK variant. I want to talk with you about what's happening in British Columbia, specifically on the West Coast. The province now has the highest rate of the P1 or Brazil variant, as we know, more cases than all of the United States. It's highly transmissible. How did it get to British Columbia?
That Brazilian variant, which is exactly as you say, it can reinfect. It is a lot more contagious, maybe three times as contagious. We don't know how it got there, but I have my suspicions. We have some really bad holes in our border protection. One of them being that if you have a private plane, you can fly to any airport in Canada you wish. So you can buy your way around those restrictions. Whistler is a very elite, expensive place to be. And I suspect that's probably how COVID made its way there.
We're also hearing that this is vaccine resistant. Can you talk a little bit more about that resistance?
We haven't vaccinated enough people to know how it behaves here yet. That's the current belief. It doesn't mean that vaccines don't work at all. It means that they're less effective. You can combat that by having a higher percentage of people being vaccinated, for example. But my belief is we're all going to need a booster down the road that is able to manage this mutation.
Okay, let's stay there for a moment. Is it possible to contain the surge at this point?
It is. It is still transmitted in ways that we understand. It's a respiratory virus. So if we control mobility, if we control the amount of contact that people have, it will have an effect. Closing schools is probably part of that. That's something Ontario did. It's something that British Columbia has not done. If this takes hold in schools, it could really be messy. But our control measures are starting to work in Ontario, so I do have some optimism.
In terms of strategy, Canada is putting its efforts also into getting a first dose into as many people as possible and is extending the 3 to 4 week interval between doses to 16 weeks. I'd love to know your thoughts on that strategy.
It's a risky strategy. Canada was the first place in the world to say 16 weeks is okay. The reasoning, the logic is quite clear. The reason why we do immunization is not to create immune individuals, it's to get COVID to stop circulating. And so the logic or the belief is that if we can create partial immunity in the population by giving everybody one dose, we can cause COVID to stop circulating sooner. Then we can circle back and do the second dose. But there's a risk, and the risk is when you create an immune population, especially if you're not taking restrictions to control transmission, you're actually giving the virus a fantastic sandbox to start to evolve more to be able to evade the vaccine more. It should work, but it won't necessarily.
Also, another thing, why has the rollout for vaccines been so slow in Canada?
The Canadian approach was to put eggs in lots of baskets. So we made purchases, not large purchases, across a wide number of vaccine candidates. And that meant that we were never going to be at the front of the line because we didn't have the purchasing power in any case. But it also meant that no matter which vaccine was successful, we would be in the line. And so that ended up being a typically Canadian, cautious, prudent approach. But it did mean that early on, the vaccines were not available in the quantities that we wanted. I don't think it was a mistake. I think it was prudent, but it meant that we had to have patience.
Can we end on a somewhat positive note? Canada also has had some major successes. Can you tell us more about those?
I think when we talk about COVID and success in the same sentence, we need to look at Atlantic Canada. There are four provinces that early on said, we're going to control travel into the region. Sometimes they restrict transportation among the provinces. They are achieving COVID zero. And once in a while, a case does get through, but they're on top of it. And they will test all the way around that case aggressively. So when the UK variant showed up in Newfoundland, it didn't stay for long. The authorities there were right on top of it because they had the capacity to be on top of it.
Well, if this region sets an example, why are we so challenged with making those hard decisions?
I would say that you have a choice as a government to treat COVID like a political problem or a public health problem. And any government that's chosen to treat it like a political problem, negotiating, bargaining, trying to come up with good news messages for people, that's a losing proposition.
Colin Furnas is an epidemiologist at the University of Toronto in Ontario. Thank you so much for this conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.